So tonight is... Now, we read this book last week. I just did it 2 weeks in a row because I thought there might be some chance I wouldn't be here tonight. And then next week, we'll go back to Isho Fujita and his provocative chapters on Zazen. But this one is on the Four Noble Truths of Practice in Times of Challenge and Struggle. So we'll just pass it around to read. Hopefully, if you don't want to read, feel free to pass it along to the next person.
The Four Noble Truths of Practice in Times of Challenge and Struggle. Miyosho N. Kylie Brown. Subheading, Is There Any Other Time to Practice? The first noble truth is a recognition that suffering exists. Here's how it began for me. Once upon a time, I was raising four children all on my own. You might think they'd arrived by virgin birth, as no one else seemed to be responsible or involved. I did not understand, nor did the children. This was great suffering. Then, after many years, I met a man who was also raising four children. Like pack horses climbing the same rocky mountain, we recognized each other. Who else could possibly understand? We married. Just like that, I doubled my yield. Stepchildren, a blended family. Apparently, I was the blender. The first years of our marriage, I was on call without surcease, day and night. Then, one dark, rainy winter Sunday, making my rounds room to room, I found everyone happily occupied. Not only was I not needed, I was actually in the way. They had taken over the dining room as a photo studio and the kitchen as a dark room. My hard-earned sense of self flopped over like a dusty stage set. What do you do when there's nothing to do? Well, people take walks. Well, people take walks, I guess. So I did.
Community newspaper had reported that a Zen temple was being built down the street from our home. Neighbors were complaining. What? I thought, too quiet? But I've been following its progress. Carpenters from Japan, wearing Spider-Man shoes, skittered all over the building. It arose like a mirage. On this particular afternoon, it was quiet. I peered through a crack in the fence. Deserted. I loved Zen. Never knew it firsthand, but when I was 12 years old, my big brother had brought home a book by Alan Watts. He also listened to Watts on the radio, KPFA. Sitting outside the bedroom door, I listened. I learned the words Zazen. Now it was the last Sunday of the year 1993. I was 48. Perhaps I can learn to meditate here. On impulse, I rang the bell by the front gate, then stood very straight and tall and waited. Nothing. Silence. I looked around. No one. I was disappointed. I climbed up onto a narrow toehold on the gate and peered over. A Japanese home. Her sentences are really short. A Japanese home. A Japanese garden. A white gravel path leading to the temple. A koi pond. It was a winter garden. Bare trees. Wet. Bleak. Spacious. Lovely. Holding to the top of the gate, I took it all in. Took my fill. Took my time. Time passed. My knuckles turned white. Suddenly it occurred to me that someone might be home. Maybe they were in the shower when I rang. Instantly I hopped down. Heavens, now I better apologize for loitering at their gate. Head down, slumped, chagrined, I rang the bell again. Nothing. Silence. No one. Now I was truly sad. In grief, actually. Who knew if I'd ever have the courage to return? I stepped back up onto the toehold, and this time, because no one was home, I let my arms hang down over the top of the gate and dangled there like an Alaskan king crab, looking. Time passed. Finally, I thought, I better go home. Someone probably needs something by now. Reluctantly, I stepped down. Then, just for the hell of it, I rang the bell a third time. Instantly, a Japanese monk popped out of the house. He had a shaved head and was wearing long black robes. He looked at me. I looked back, scared. Slowly, he walked towards me. My God, I thought, what am I going to do now? Just then, a shadow passed overhead. I looked up. A white crane. In Oakland, it glided towards the pond, rose, and began a dive. Instantly, the monk whisked his long black sleeves up into the air. The muscular crane flapped its big white wings in the sky. Again, the monk shot his sleeves out, snapping them at the very heart of the crane. Back and forth they went, black and white. My hair blew in the wind they created. Instantly, all the buildings around the temple disappeared. Only mountains, valleys, gorges, rivers, and streams remained as far as my eye could see. And silence. Where am I? Then, just as suddenly as it had arrived, the magnificent crane flew off, vanishing into the vast gray sky. The monk looked back at me. Oh my God, he came and opened the gate. I didn't know if he spoke English. I only knew one word. Zazen, welcome, he said.
I followed him. He showed me an unlocked side gate where I could enter day or night. He led me to the temple. Paint cans and the ladder still stood in the corner, but already it smelled of incense. A flyer on the wall announced an upcoming retreat, something called a session. May I attend, I asked. Yes, he said. Do I need to wear special clothes or read a book or take a class? No, he laughed. You already Buddha. You sit, you remember. Of course, I misunderstood. I thought he had recognized me as a special human being. Finally. It was a long time before I realized that everyone is Buddha. If everyone sits, everyone will remember. Nonetheless, deluded by encouragement, I went on session.
Starting at 5 a.m., we sat cross-legged in Zazen without moving for 50 minutes at a time, 10 times each day. Then 3 times a day, we stood barefoot on the cold floor and chanted in deep, monotonous Japanese. Then we did many full prostrations, foreheads to the same cold floor. We ate our meals in silence, no eye contact. This was to go on for 7 days.
On the fourth day, there was an interview with the monk. His wife was present to translate. I sat cross-legged in front of them and started talking right away. I was so excited. Who can remember what I had to say that day? His wife interrupted, "Where are you from?" "Down the street," I answered. No, she said, "I mean, what Zen center?" "No Zen center." "But where do you sit?" "Here." "You mean this is the first time you have meditated?" "Yes." "And you started with session?" "You're crazy." She screeched something in Japanese to the monk and immediately he leaned over and lifted up my skirt. Okay, let me make sure I read this correctly, all right? All right, said something to the Japanese monk. Oh, she screeched something to the Japanese monk and immediately leaned over and lifted up my skirt. "Let me see your posture." They stared at my underpants and my bare, sore legs.
This, just so you know, this lady, the wife, she also runs a well-known nightclub in Oakland. She's quite a lady.
Why? Why would I put myself through this? A middle-aged woman with completely whacked adrenal gland and strong suspicion I would never know rest again. Why? Because I had come to the end of the known world. And if you are a mother and you come to the end of the known world, your children are in danger. The second noble truth is that there is a cause of suffering. What is the cause? Each of our children is a whole story. As am I, as are you. They took turns teetering on the outer edges of reality. The eldest struggled with mental illness, another flirted with an eating disorder, one used drugs, another had fragile nerves and was dyslexic. One was a surly member of the punk movement. The youngest had a genetic condition that made him look different than other people. The others were garden variety, neurotic, and wonderful. What kind of people would have children like this? Our kind.
But if you came to our home for dinner, you would have thought they were quite lovely. At that moment, I was beset with worry for the one on drugs. She was also in trouble with the law. And she had tried to kill herself. The nuns found her on the roof of the Catholic Recovery Center. She hadn't known the right way to cut her wrists. Not a small blessing. I was terrified. I was also confused, ashamed, desperate, embarrassed, angry, righteous, judgmental, blaming, sanctimonious, apologetic, frustrated, guilty, and powerless. Nothing I did or said helped. Every conversation ended badly. What do you do when you don't know what to do? My grandmother used to say, when in doubt, don't. So I didn't. I sat. It was hard keeping my back straight. Such was the weight of my sorrow. I tried to clear my mind, count to 10, follow my fractured breath. But all I could see was my daughter flailing at night in a stormy sea, waves crashing all about her, drowning. All I could hear were my useless platitudes and admonitions, as well as those of my mother and grandmother, and on back in time. The only feeling available was dread.
Finally, I gave up. I slumped. I surrendered to the unknowable mess of it. In that instant, all moral judgments of her and of myself fell away. It was clear. She wasn't bad, rebellious, or ignorant. She was sick. My daughter was sick. I left the Zendo and rushed home to call her. It is mysterious how the heart opens, how minds heal, how people connect. What was different in that phone call to my daughter? Two things. I was compassionate and I listened. She felt it and opened up. The healing began right there. Zazen is the mystery. It is also the practice. What is the cause of suffering? It is actually quite simple. We want what we want. When we don't get it, we get mad. Some of us turn that anger against ourselves. Some of us strive to get even. Some do both. That's the mess of it right there.
The third noble truth is that there is an end to suffering. How do you end greed? I turned to my teacher for instruction, but as he didn't really teach with words, I was flummoxed. I thought it was rude to stare. Still, sometimes I would sneak a peek at him. If he caught my eye, I would quickly turn away. Then one day I realized that whenever I did look at him, he suddenly started moving in slow motion. How does one suddenly move slowly?
Well, if lifting a teacup, for instance, he would stop and look at the cup as if he had never seen one before in his entire life and had no idea how it had gotten into his hand. Watching him inspect the cup, I could feel his wonder, his curiosity, the heft of the cup, its heat, the texture of its glaze. Then I looked down at my own cup, the one I'd been using for months already, and realized that I had never really seen it before. To look is not to see. To see requires letting go of, well, you're usually looking at, which is more than likely greed, often in the form of desire for something more or different. After that, I didn't take my eyes off of him. He was teaching me.
Still, he traveled frequently to Japan. As a result, his wife became my new North Star. She can be ferocious. She's perfect and imperfect at the same time, fair and unfair at the same time, inspiring and daunting, dedicated and generous. She overcomes tiredness like an athlete, pushing through. She is a dancer. Though we were almost the same age, I followed her around like a puppy. In a specialty shop, I saw some fine linen handkerchiefs with beautifully embroidered linen envelopes. One said mother, one said friend, one said teacher. I gave her the one that said teacher. What she teaches is tea ceremony. Many young Japanese women come to study tea. Japanese mothers send their daughters. Zen priests send their wives. Tea ceremony is one of the Zen arts. Often, an older Japanese woman named Yoko-san would be there. She and my teacher's wife were good friends. Yoko-san loved to laugh. Westerners came as well. It takes years to be granted the right to make tea. You start as a guest. After a very long time, you become the second guest. After an even longer time, you become the first guest. Then, finally, after time immemorial, you become otame, which means that you are the one who gets to make the tea. By the time you are as graceful as a tendril, the first guest and second guest speak to each other in set Japanese phrases. The first guest bows and offers the second guest her tea and sweets, saying, Osaki ni chodo itashimasu, which means, please excuse me that I will be receiving this before you. The second guest bows and says, Doso, meaning, oh no, please, you go ahead and enjoy it first. These phrases are repeated all the way down the line, guest to guest. It is difficult to learn to say them correctly. Then, after you finish your tea, you lean over and carefully inspect the cup, tilting your head gracefully to the left and then to the right. You appreciate it. The first time I inspected the cup, I went too quickly. My teacher's wife stopped me. Sihofen, she said. I offered the cup to the next guest, bowed, and repeated, Sihofen. Yoko-san burst out laughing. You are a good monkey, she said. My teacher's wife had spoken English, see whole thing. If you want to see the whole thing, you can't take your greed, anger, and delusions with you. Thus, I saw that there could be an end to suffering.
The fourth noble truth is that there is indeed a path to the end of suffering. Zazen is the path. My family moved just like that. Last child still at home, just 2 years before he had to go to college. I was happily planning for the rest of my life at last. Oh, the places I'd go. My husband got a job opportunity in a small town, hours north of our home, way out in the countryside. One day, I'm preparing for my future. The next, he's carting my grandmother's stand-up mirror out the door. Where do you think you're going with that? In 30 days flat, we moved. There are many good practical reasons for this, my husband said, but for me, it was a disaster, a hurricane, a tornado, an earthquake, a firestorm, an act of God. As you may know, there is no insurance for acts of God. I did not miss our friends, family, or neighbors. I did not miss the shops, cafes, or morning walks. I missed my teacher. I missed his wife. I missed the Sangha. There was no Zen temple in our new community, so no new Zen teacher. there was a collective of Buddhist practitioners from many traditions, Thai, Tibetan, and American non-denominational. Two people were Zen, one very old and one a hermit. It was a democratic group. They had meetings to decide the way forward. Thus, there were politics. But a group cannot vote to become enlightened. Only an individual can step into that path. Without a teacher, it is tricky. Unaware of what I was doing, I commenced the life of a peripatetic monk. Traveling farther and farther afield, I sought out every temple, monastery, and Zen center within a day's drive. I would land on their doorsteps like a snowdrift. If they did not sweep me away, I would enter and practice with them. 1 hour, 1 day, 3 days, 7 days, 10 days, a month. Thus, I met many teachers. Thus, I tasted many flavors of the way. One day, I spoke with my teacher and his wife about becoming a monk. It was decided I would go to Japan to train. My husband was nonplussed. He had not married a monk. He put his foot down, both of them. There are many good practical reasons for this, I told him. No, he said. I looked right at him. Do not say you love me and then tell me I cannot go to Japan. He was silent for a time. Then he said, I love you. I shaved my head. I took vows. I took new vows. I was ordained. I asked my teacher what I needed to do to prepare for Japan. Go to Japan, he said. I was terrified.
Monks in a monastery are leaves in a forest. The wind blows them this way and that. You do everything together. You work together, eat together, study together, bathe together, sleep together. At night, if you roll over, you might find your nose inches from another's nose. You are never alone. I did not speak Japanese. I didn't understand anything. I was profoundly uncomfortable. At first I thought, well, I'll get used to this in a week or two, but no, on and on it went. I projected my fears and insecurities onto everyone. I imagined insults and slurs. I took umbrage at I know not what. I came up with clever rejoinders to emptiness. I rehearsed retorts to the unknown. I craved a free moment to translate these words using my English to Japanese dictionary. That moment never came. If I approached mastery of any task, they took it right away and gave me a new one. I was appalled, but slowly, very slowly, I moved from paranoia to realizing that this was not personal. It was training. They were helping me. Then, 2 months or so into my stay, during afternoon tea on a lovely summer day, a feeling of deep well-being and spaciousness came over me. It was startling. Words came spontaneously, Japanese words. Kurewanandeska. What is this? I looked inward. Yes, indeed. I was still uncomfortable, but now I saw that I had grown comfortable being uncomfortable. I was free. But what is freedom? I met many people in Japan. One priest invited me to come to Bangladesh to help in an orphanage, a dangerous place of deep need. A Korean nun asked if I would come to Switzerland with her and speak at an international congress of women in Buddhism. Good heavens, other opportunities arose. All of a sudden, like a white crane in Oakland, I realized I could just raise my foot and step out into a new world. I was at the airport in Tokyo waiting to go home. The loudspeaker announced the imminent departure of the plane to Seoul, Korea. My friend waved to me from the next gate. I waved back. I was free. I raised my foot. I thought of my eldest daughter who was going to have a baby. My husband, who was so good to me. They were my first vow, my first sangha, my family. I was free. I was free to join the line of folks going back to San Francisco.
So unless I missed something, her husband was not at all a part of her developing interest and participation in Buddhism. Is that correct?
I don't know, actually.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't sound like he was at least not as involved as she was.
I still can't get over the fact. Why did he lift her skirt?
It was a little rude, but they were trying to. They realized she had never been taught how to sit zazen, so they were wondering how she was physically sitting underneath there. I know in the whole atmosphere, but Yoshi was there. It wasn't just her teacher. It was Yoshi that lifted up her skirt to see how her legs were.
And she pointed out that her legs were sore, and she'd probably been sitting long. Well, she'd been sitting a lot. So
she'd already been sitting for several 10 hours a day for several days.
Well, she's a bit of a comic in a sense. I mean, she did make that funny, so that's just kind of a funny thing to happen on the way to Zen.
So she's now a priest or a Zen monk?
Kyocho, yeah. Although now she's 72. But yeah. So.
Okay, I was wondering why she went to Japan. So back at that time, there probably wasn't a lot of places to practice here.
Well, there was Tassajara, and there was Zen Mountain Monastery and places like that, but her teacher is Gengo Akiba Roshi, and his temple's in Oakland, and he's the he's attached to the Japanese school, Soto school, and I believe he's currently, in their eyes, Bishop of North America. So, I mean, that she chose a teacher who's actually really connected to Japan. Other questions or comments?
So let me ask a kind of a personal question. This story seemed to affect you deeply. Could you help me understand what was going on?
I don't know, that last description of deciding to go back to her family, which is just, I guess for me, and this is what I wanted to bring out, this is kind of an unusual essay. It's not really about Buddhist principles. It's about this, her story, and then she was illustrating for us how these principles, how she experienced these principles. And, you know, that fourth truth, the fourth noble truth, is about path. And we all find our own path. And it's the path is toward learning, toward growth, toward awakening, toward compassion, toward being true to ourselves. So, you know, our paths don't all look alike. And that, I don't know. I mean, and pretty much everything that she explained, but particularly when she described those moments of recognizing, like in the tea ceremony, recognizing how you can leave behind your greed, hate, and delusion to really see something, or in the monastery where she really felt free, and then she really sees what her path is. You know, those. I don't know, those moments we think in Buddhism that this insight is going to be about some transcendent thing, but it ends up being like that. It ends up being about our place and time and our next step. And yet it's profound at the same time. There's a certain kind of, you know, clarity coming together, or a resolution that I think it's tears of gratitude and awe that that kind of thing occurs, that practice can help us toward that kind of thing.
Is this what you were hoping for yourself and for all of us?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was really struck by her time in Japan, which I knew no Japanese except Zazen, you know, but very little. And everything was hard. She was never alone, and there were people, you know, up against her. It was very, very hard. And then she realized that they're teaching her and they're helping her.
Mm.
That they're not torturing her. Yeah, I read another book similar to that, a young California woman
who
went to Japan and went through all that too, and then at some point she realized, oh, this is valuable, this is good for me.
Yeah.
That struck me.
It's interesting, because last week we read from the book about the woman who, the teacher who was first hit by a falling wall and then second hit by an SUV, so she had two life-changing injuries, and how that she went from being a teacher to a very good teacher, and how it deepened her practice. And it's interesting. Yeah. Here, it was kind of in similar ways. She didn't suffer injuries, but she suffered changes in her life.
Yeah.
I mean, suddenly her role as mother was disappearing. And maybe at that point she was not feeling that role was too good, or she hadn't played that role well because of the problems her children were having. And so, you know, through that crisis, both of their crises, one found a deep practice and one deepened their practice.
Yeah, I still struggle with how to... how to convey to people how to approach their lives this way. Maybe I'm getting it across, I don't know. But, I don't know. It's not, what I think it is we don't have language for this kind of thing in our tradition yet, or we're just developing it, because throughout the millennia this has been a monastic practice. So to train, if you wanted to train, then you would insert yourself into that kind of container like she did, and then you don't really have to worry about anything, you just endure it. if you can endure it, the stuff will happen generally. But most practitioners aren't going to be doing that. You know, for one reason or another, we're doing in the midst of lay lives. But it can be done. I mean, after all, that monastic part, that was just one part of her story. You know, there were all these other aspects of her story where she recognized these other aspects of the truths. And so Kyogen would call it being ordained into your life. And, you know, the exercise, which I'm not going to have you get around to having you do, but was to really, really sit and reflect on what is a real life experience you've had of recognizing dukkha, recognizing that dissatisfactoriness. Seeing it in your own experience, just never really being satisfied, or just seeing it. Oh, I see, that's what the Buddha was talking about, and exactly how that manifested for you. And then seeing the cause. So she saw how she was so worried about her daughter, and how that was, you know, though she didn't want it to be that way, and that was fueling this dukkha. And then the end of the third noble truth is the ending of this, recognizing in what way, in some ways, we can let go So she recognized that in that tea ceremony. I can just, like, let go of that thought or let go of that desire. Or we just, sometimes I describe it as we just end up finding a off switch. You can't always find it, but sometimes you can just find an off switch and go, oh, I mean, oh, if I just didn't, you know, for instance, getting into a dysfunctional struggle with somebody and realizing what you're demanding that they approve or understand, or, you know, you're expecting some kind of response from this person and they're not giving it to you. And then recognizing that, oh, and then being able to go, oh, well, I don't really have to have that from that person. And then there's such ease. And then the fourth being a path of recognizing what your way forward is. So I was going to ask you to, like, look at your life and find those things, because they're there. So really, I feel like part of my job as a teacher and part of what my teachers did for me was help me look at my life that way. Help me start parsing my life that way, describing it that way, seeing it through that lens. Does that make any sense or intrigue anyone? Any other thoughts?
It brings to mind the great Zen teacher, Spock. One line he had was, you know, wanting something is not the same as having it. Many times in my life, I have wanted something, and then when I got it, it was like, oh. Dukkha.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Kyogen used to describe if you could imagine you pick, you know, you shop very, very, very carefully and you buy the most comfortable chair ever. Just fits you perfectly. You can recline. It's just the most comfortable chair ever. Okay, after 5 hours, is it comfortable? Maybe. After 10 hours, is it comfortable? After 24 hours, is it comfortable? Yeah, there you go. That's dukkha, right? Nothing is permanently satisfying.
I've been thinking about, like, what you've taught in the podcast about, and maybe you can remind, I'm not saying it correctly, but about how you've talked about our aliveness and the stuff that happens to us is the content. It was in the podcast where you say that stuff is the stuff that moves through us, you know what I'm saying? Where, like, intrusive thoughts or emotions or whatever suffering that you have, is if you can look at that it's not, that you can set that aside. I'm not saying it right. The content that you said, if we can look at that and have it, it's not our aliveness. If we can be in a space of being our sense of aliveness, and that's not the content. The stuff that happens to us is can be separate if we can look at I'm not saying it right.
Well, I wonder if something similar is reflected in her experience at the monastery where you know, she's just miserable. Uh-huh. But then at a certain point, she just gave up resisting the misery in a way. And it's all part of it then. Mm-hmm. It's right. Like nothing, all of that, and including our reactions to it and our shortcomings and our limitations and all that kind of stuff is just, I don't know. It's part of the movie. It's part of the play, you know?
I think In her case, she didn't understand what was going on, so she started making up stories.
But even when when you speak the language and you know what's going on,
okay.
you still make up the stories.
That's it, when she realized they were teaching. She stopped making up the stories.
Which is so funny, because people just assume monasteries are these places you go and you achieve calm and peace, and it's removed from the craziness of life, and it would be a wonderful refuge. It's like, well, for a little bit, maybe. And then, you know, you've brought all of your stuff.
I was going to say, I always felt like you could kind of concentrate that craziness.
Exactly, like there you are. I always imagined there's some better place. So I wanted to be in a monastery instead of at this lay temple where I had to train. And I went down to Tassajara. And for the practice period, you know, that was nice and intense. But then if you're going to be at a Tassajara practice period, you have to stay for the summertime and work. And guests come in, and they make fancy food for them, and they soak in the hot springs. And it's a resort for the summer. And, you know, I mean, you sit a little zazen in the morning and the evening. And I was just like, this is just unacceptable. So then I was dreaming of more rigorous monasteries I could go to. I mean, when it was like, whatever monastery I went to wouldn't be good enough. Which is why my teacher told me to come on back and didn't send me to a monastery. And she told me, if you can't do the practice here, you can't do it anywhere. Mm-hmm. Which really made me mad. But it was like her in that tight container, and then finally finding freedom and going, oh, cool. Well, I don't have to be afraid of discomfort anymore anyway.
She kind of described that in each section of it. Not always, most of the time it was at the end, but there was in the first one when she was talking about standing up on the gate and then seeing the crane and everything like that. For a moment, she just let everything go and saw things. And then the second one, she realized her problems with her daughter, that her daughter had the sickness, and then she just let go of all of that, all the myriad of emotions that she was having before, and letting those. And then she had an earnest conversation with her. And then the third one, she, you know, realized with the passing of the teacup, you know, that she wasn't, she was holding on to her preconceptions about it and let go of those. And then, of course, the last one was when she let go of all of her, you know, ideas about what things should be and how they are.
Well, may we all have such insights.